Hello and welcome to this week's CBI at 10. I'm Jeevan Vasagar, I'm climate editor at Tortoise Media. I'm joined by Tom Thackeray, who's program director for decarbonisation at the CBI, Catherine Chapman, who's managing director at the clean energy business Ameresco, Gabriel Vondrache, who's strategy director at Sungift Solar. The subject we're here to talk about today couldn't really be more timely. We're talking about the rise in energy prices this year and the steps that your business can take now to reduce energy costs. Tom, over to you first. Can you give us a sense of how increased energy prices are going to impact businesses? I mean, this is going to really affect businesses as well as households, isn't it? And how do you see this unfolding over the next few months?
I think the first thing to say was is that, you know, this is not the only issue that is impacting businesses and business costs at the moment. So when we talk to our members at the CBI, we're hearing things around wider supply chain disruptions, the cost of commodities, labour shortages, general inflation. And so there's a hell of a lot going on at the moment, and energy costs are should be understood in the round with all of those other challenges being faced by businesses and the headwinds that we're facing in the economy at the moment. But specifically on energy, obviously businesses do not have a price cap in the same way that consumers do. So they've been facing into these higher costs for a long period of time, and actually pre-existed the conflict in Ukraine, although that situation has made it more acute. So businesses' hedge positions, their long-term contracts have tended to lapse now. So they're either, you know, buying energy at the spot price, which is very volatile at the moment, can be very, very high, has been up to sort of 500% above normal levels, or they're trying to renegotiate contracts, which can be, which is the starting position is sometimes two or three times the contract that they were previously on. So that's an incredibly challenging position for businesses to try and manage. And that's a massive cost uptick for most businesses. Obviously, it doesn't impact all businesses equally. Questions that businesses are asking themselves are, you know, can you pass that cost on to your customers? Because you are going to have to adjust to a new normal. If you look at the gas futures prices, it looks like we're going to see elevated levels for the next 2 or 3 years. So there needs to be an adjustment to that new way of operating. And then there's a distinction based on how much energy you use as well. And I think we're seeing the particular pressure on sectors, the industrial sectors, basically, you know, glass, ceramics, steel, chemicals, industrial gases. And they are particularly under pressure, one, because they use a lot of energy, so their costs have gone up markedly more. And two, because they tend to be in globally traded sectors where they're in competition with other companies in Germany or the Far East or the USA. And so they're in that global competition, so they can't pass on the costs quite so easily. So that's hugely challenging.
They just lose market share.
Yeah, if they just lose market share, and you know, they're sort of testing the extent to which they can pass on costs, but you know, some of them are losing customers as a result.
Tom, what's your view of the political response to this? I mean, obviously, you know, at the time that we're speaking, we're right in the middle of the political response being prepared. But how do you read the runes on this?
I don't think we've come to the end of the road in terms of the political response. So we've seen the government step in to support customers through the energy bill rebate earlier in the spring, and some reductions in council tax. I think that's gone some way, but they're going to need to go further when it comes to the next rise in the price cap in the autumn, which is just going to put millions of households literally under pressure with increases in their costs. On the business side of things, I think the main vehicle for addressing the challenges we're currently facing was through the British Energy Security Strategy, which was launched a few weeks ago, maybe months ago. And I think, you know, there were all kinds of rumours what would be included in that strategy. I think what it did do on the positive side was provide political backing on the generation side for some important technologies like hydrogen, renewables, and particularly for nuclear power. There was a good focus on sort of greasing the wheels for getting that generation up and running quickly. So looking at the planning system, consenting to make sure that we up our game in terms of the delivery of the infrastructure. And there was the indication of some support for the energy intensive businesses that I mentioned earlier. There's probably more that they can do in that space as well. I think the big deficiency in the government response so far is that they haven't really looked at the demand side. And particularly for households, you know, we've got some of the leakiest houses in Europe. Energy efficiency measures are you know, is the only thing that's going to make a difference this winter and spring and next spring. So it's really a no-brainer that we have an all-round national effort to insulate homes, and it makes sense for the government to stump up some money to help households with that.
And a windfall tax?
Yeah, I think it's inevitable that these kind of things are superficially attractive, but I think it's, you know, careful what you wish for in that regard. There is a huge amount of investment that is required at the moment in the transition in the energy system. We need the size of our electricity generation capacity needs to be double what it is today if we're going to hit net zero by 2050. So that's a huge amount of offshore wind, renewables, onshore, solar, nuclear power, and some backup gas with carbon capture and storage. So that's a massive amount of investment. And if you're sort of penalising businesses at the moment with a windfall tax, it just makes the sort of relative investment case in the UK relative to other markets much more challenging. So I think it's a difficult situation, and I don't think the windfall tax is the one that the government should be pursuing at the moment.
And you've just sketched out really clearly how serious the economic situation is. What do you think this means for our environmental objectives and the transition to net zero?
I think from a business perspective, when I talk to our members about net zero in the current conditions, there's no sense of sort of softening their commitments. A lot of them have made long-term net zero commitments, which, you know, can be as early as 2030. So that strategy hasn't really changed over the long term, but in the short term, it's become challenging. And for some companies, it's just a question of cash. Actually, you know, in those industrial sectors, I've seen companies who had investment plans for, you know, fuel switching, for example, which have had to push those to the right because they just don't have the cash flow needed to make them this year. Politically, I think there's been increased focus, I think, in Parliament around, particularly from those on the right in the back benches, pushing back against some of the net zero strategy. But I think the government has held firm, and I think they're right to do so.
Thanks, Tom. And before I turn to our other panellists, I just want to remind everyone that you can submit questions to our panellists, and please just put them in the chat. Catherine, coming to you, could you give us a bit of background first, please, about Ameresco? Tell us a bit about the products and services that you provide.
Yes, hopefully I'm unmuted. Hello, everybody. Yes, I'm Kath Chapman, Managing Director of Ameresco, and we provide a whole range of what I would describe as both physical and commercial energy related solutions to both the INC sector and to the public sector as well. And I actually would echo an awful lot of what Tom has said about challenging times for businesses, not just in relation to energy, but the whole supply chain. So we look at providing services that might range from on-site generation, major energy efficiency projects, right through to commercial solutions. And these solutions can often sit, and they have to sit hand in hand with the ESG objectives and the net zero journey. And we also, Tom, are not seeing people or businesses, you know, pull back from that commitment. So it's a matter of what is the right mix of commercial and physical solutions that can secure your long-term energy solution. And for a lot of businesses, it's to take away the awful volatility that we've seen over the last sort of, you know, 12 months. And as you say, that volatility started before the Ukrainian situation. And we also see these high prices continuing for the next 2 to 3 years, because the solutions are not immediate solutions. There's not something that's going to come along in the next 6 months and, you know, address the fundamental increased demand for gas that we have. So it's a matter of providing a mix of solutions for customers. And I think people are also, or businesses are also, getting to the stage where they realise, you know, it's not just about securing an energy supply contract for 1, 2 or 3 years. It's about having a mix. It's about having a balanced risk portfolio. So it's more akin to a financial strategy where you have, you know, options that range from 1 year right out to 10 years, say a commercial power purchase agreement, or, you know, solutions of that kind. So it's a much more, it's about helping customers in a much more sophisticated energy journey that is a combination of multiple factors. And that's really where we help customers, whether it's the installation of, like I say, on-site renewable generation, or whether it might be, you know, that's not possible for every business because they might not be located in an area where that's suitable. They might, you know, have offices in London. So it doesn't lend itself well to that kind of solution. But for those, there are commercial solutions that we can provide to them and also help them in how do they face the immediate increases that they're looking at, because everybody comes out of a supply contract at some point. And even if you bought really, really well when, you know, prices fell as a result of COVID, at some point, you know, the over-the-counter market only lasts about 3 years. So at some point, you're going to have to face these high prices and this new world that we're going to be living in, at least for the medium term. On the positive side, it does mean that projects like on-site generation, significant investment in energy efficiency is back on the board's agenda, and the paybacks that we're looking at for those are becoming much more attractive. And therefore, it's easier to get them over the sort of the CapEx business case type hurdles. So we're finding that we're seeing a lot more interest in those types of projects. In terms of government support as well, I think for the energy intensive industries, which, as you say, you know, the likes of the glass sector, the brick sector, those, you know, there are some support schemes out there. And I know they're about to go out to consultation on another one of those support schemes. And we would certainly hope to see those schemes expanded, both in terms of the sectors that it covers and the level of support that's provided, because in that way, you know, government can provide support for those energy intensive industries. And, you know, it is difficult for businesses that operate in a global market, because if you look at the cost base of a business in the USA, for example, it's very different from an energy perspective than it is across Europe. Because they have a different mix of energy and, you know, they're much more self-sufficient. So it does make that carbon leakage an issue for UK firms.
Because, of course, Ameresco is a US company, isn't it? So you've got this kind of perspective on the US as well. Could you just go a bit deeper into some of the conversations you're having with clients, Kath, and give us a sense of, what's the sort of demand trajectory from your clients, and what are the conversations you're having with them about the challenges that they're facing?
Yes, so the demand that we're really seeing the increase in terms of services is, I think there's a general acceptance that, you know, this problem is not going to go away, and therefore, you know, you're going to be looking at a higher cost base over the next 12 to 18 months. And those are difficult discussions, but we're having to have those. But it is meaning that the whole sort of concept about having a range of solutions rather than just looking at buying on the wholesale market is much more attractive. So we've seen a huge uptake in the demand for things like commercial power purchase agreements, whereas before that wasn't very much on the board agenda, or it was really the domain of the very, very large users. We're seeing that coming down the chain, if you like, and smaller users saying, actually, you know, I am prepared to commit to a 10-year structure. It meets my ESG requirements. It gives me stability. So what we're seeing, the real increase in demand is for longer-term solutions that provide a stable cost base. Because as you say, some businesses can pass on these cost increases, some can't. And whereas before it was more about, you know, what's the cheapest price I can get, now it's more about how can I stabilize my future energy costs. And we've also seen a huge increase because of that in terms of a desire for on-site generation, whether that's funded by the business or whether that's done through a structured, you know, longer term offtake type agreement. So there's a much bigger appetite for looking at a wider range of solutions than we saw, than we've really seen in the last 10 years, because a lot of these solutions have been available for the last 10 years, but there hasn't been the appetite. So it's this, you know, how do we reduce our volatility and secure a long-term solution, albeit with the need to face pain probably over the next 12 to 18 months.
So this is a crisis that's really focusing people's minds.
Correct.
Kath, could you just give us a sense of, yes.
And they're also taking this opportunity to tie it in with their carbon objectives. So it's seeing the two together. And there's no doubt that it is on the board agenda now. You know, we're spending a lot more time presenting to boards and saying, this is what you need to do. This is what it's going to look like for the next 12 months. Yeah, and energy efficiency, which has never been, you know, a particularly sexy topic for a lot of businesses, let's be honest. But there's nothing focuses a board's mind like, you know, you're facing 150% increase in your cost of delivered energy. And the other focus, I think, for businesses is the appreciation that what makes up their cost base of electricity and gas, particularly in electricity, where there are the third party charges, where there are a lot of policy charges, and that's where government can come in and provide support.
We absolutely don't want this to become a sexy topic, that's what I would say. Kath, you've touched on the question of duration and the sort of length of contracts. Could you say a bit more on that point? So what advice are you giving about the sort of structure and timing of energy contracting strategies?
Yes, so we are back to sort of thinking about energy solutions as more akin to sort of a financial solution. So you have a range of different options available, everything from the day ahead, which may be acceptable for some businesses because commercially that sometimes gives you the best solution, albeit a very volatile solution, right through to, you know, having your normal 3-year contract in place. But then we would also say, you know, you need to look at 5- and 10-year solutions. You don't just need to have one solution. So it is more akin to a financial strategy where, you know, you wouldn't buy everything on, you know, a 1-month type solution, and moving away from just looking at the sort of the over-the-counter flexible supply contract type arrangement. And those are, it's getting people's heads right around the fact that this is a, you know, a structured portfolio solution. And for some businesses, it may include, even if they're acceptable, you know, we can see financial derivatives out there, power swaps are available. So it's looking at those kinds of instruments, as well as, you know, what do we do about our next 3-year supply contract? And having multiple parties within that, because it doesn't have to be one party providing every solution. You know, you can have a transaction that might be a power swap with one entity. You can do a power purchase agreement with a different entity. You can have a physical on-site solution with another entity. So it's multiple parties bringing together that end energy solution coupled with your ESG objectives.
And since you've brought us on to think about ESG and renewables, what's the ROI now of installing renewable energy sources?
Okay, well, given the current market, it's looking very attractive, I have to say. So the challenge historically has always been with the installation of solar, and I'm sure Gabriel will agree with this. Sometimes it's a length of payback time. But what we're finding is that isn't such an issue anymore, because everybody's getting their head around the need for a long-term solution, whether it's a government-led long-term solution or it's a business-led long-term solution. So what we're finding with ROI is actually, you know, your renewables are looking fairly attractive. And it's not just about ROI anymore. It is typically for sort of energy efficiency type projects and the capex involved in that. But certainly for your renewable on-site generation, they're not just looking at ROI. It's more about securing their own supply and security of supply than it is about ROI. So the conversation's flipped. It's not, you know, do I hit my 10%? Do I hit my 12%? Or whatever it might be. It's more about, how do I secure a long-term solution? So ROI isn't the key driver anymore.
Right. Thanks, Kath. Gabriel, turning to you and focusing more on solar, can you just talk us through the current situation with solar energy? And is the crisis that we're facing now really sort of driving more interest in investment?
Yeah, well, we've been going 17 years. So, you know, I've been involved in this industry from, you know, where putting a couple of kilowatts a week on was, you know, quite an achievement. And so we've seen, you know, some pretty significant growth over the years. The kind of industry term we have is the solar coaster, which is basically because of all the coming and going government incentives, we've had massive, you know, increases in demand followed by dips. And so when the government incentives were basically removed a couple of years ago, we were actually quite pleased. We sort of had stability, and we had a couple of years, and then obviously there was a global pandemic, and so we had another bit of a dip, but that dip only lasted for a very short period of time. We saw a pretty significant increase in demand for renewables, and you know, but it was a nice kind of steady increase, but it was a good increase. And then obviously what's happened recently with the energy prices is effectively that Catherine was talking about the, you know, the ROI. ROI still sort of plays a part in it. So the main benefit from solar is obviously you're saving on buying your energy in from the grid. So if the cost of energy goes up 10%, it makes solar look a little bit more attractive. If it triples within the space of a few months, all of a sudden solar is just on the agenda of sort of everyone. So we are currently in a situation where, you know, the company is growing again. You know, we're up to sort of nearly 40 people, and the biggest challenge for us is finding skilled people to, you know, training people to, whether it's in the office in the design side or on the tools on the installation side. But we're essentially seeing a more growth now and higher demand than we've ever seen in 17 years. We are genuinely in a situation where we can't answer the phone. The phone rings nonstop off the hook. And so if you're interested in our services, you basically have to email or you have to go in through the website because we physically can't answer the phone. It's a very, very strange situation to be in. But it's nice, obviously, I'm very much sort of environmentally motivated. So every solar panel we install, every clean energy system we do is a win. So, you know, the fact that we're able to deploy more than ever before makes me happy. But it's essentially, you know, demand has gone through the roof. So we've got customers who, sometimes businesses take quite a while to make decisions, especially sort of big multinational businesses where there are lots of sort of different chains of command. But we're now getting businesses that we have been talking to genuinely for 10 years plus who haven't been able to make a decision are suddenly not only making decisions, but they're getting involved in quite ambitious rollouts with very ambitious timescales. So it's gone. Nothing short of completely crazy in the renewables industry right now. We can't get enough stock. We can't get enough people. We can't answer the phone enough. And we're just doing our best to, you know, look after as many clients as possible.
We're grateful that you're giving us your time this morning, Gabriel. It sounds like a good kind of trouble to have. Can you just tell us a bit about the practicalities of this? So if we're thinking about the kinds of buildings, what are the differences between fitting solar to new builds and older buildings?
Yeah, well, I mean, solar is, you know, it's essentially, you know, we're just putting together bits of kit. You know, you've got panels and inverters and cabling, and, you know, on the face of it, it may, you know, be very simple. But actually, there is a lot of skill and expertise that goes into it. And I'd say that the main thing is understanding the site, understanding the demand, understanding the client's requirements, and then basically ensuring that you've got the most sort of suitable technology to meet that demand. So with new build projects, it's fairly straightforward. You know, you fit into a program with the build, and it's really, you know, sort of just making sure that you've got the right people lined up with the right roles and responsibilities of who's doing what in the build. The vast majority of the deployment we're doing is retrofit on existing buildings. And that's really where the kind of challenges come in. A lot of the existing buildings we're working on, you know, they can have quite an interesting, you know, electrical infrastructure. They generally weren't built, you know, a lot of them have been expanded many times over the years. There can be lots of different setups, different metering arrangements and stuff on site. So it's really important that there's a thorough sort of understanding of the site sort of carried out. So you're making sure that the technologies that we're looking at are sort of appropriate for that site. But it's not just understanding the sort of historical information and energy usage, but what's going to change, what might happen next. People might get some electric vehicles, right? You know, that might just happen. Electric vehicles, you know, for companies, if you look at, there's at the moment, the deployment is quite kind of niche that we're seeing is sort of lots of directors and stuff are getting some electric vehicles, maybe one or two electric vans. But these are, you know, we're talking with companies with, you know, parking spaces with hundreds and hundreds of vehicles. And you start looking at electrifying that fleet, the infrastructure required to install that charging infrastructure, but then the power required to deliver it, you're suddenly looking at not just covering all the roofs and everything, but then you're looking at, you know, potentially carports, solar carports and everything sort of in the car park. So they can be, you have to look at all of this at the beginning to make sure you don't end up redoing works sort of over and over again and essentially potentially wasting you know, sort of time and money. So, you know, I'd say that the key thing is a really thorough understanding, you know, good consultation with the clients, understanding how their business works, understanding how any technologies that we're going to deliver integrate into that business without causing any disruption. And, you know, again, these are technical systems. These are, you know, they do require upkeep and maintenance. That's the other side as well, making sure that whatever you're delivering has a sort of basic inbuilt maintenance program to ensure that it is going to deliver its expected returns over the lifetime.
And Gabriel, what sort of scale of businesses do you work with? So, I mean, how suitable is solar for the sort of smaller kind of and medium-sized enterprises?
It's, I mean, so we work with, you know, one of the proudest moments where there's a well-known coffee chain that employed us and we installed a panel on their roof. You can see it on Google Maps. That was very exciting. Or we do systems where there's, you know, tens of thousands of panels on roofs. So we do everything. We have a residential department. And we do projects, for instance, where hundreds of houses working together with solar and batteries as one sort of energy system that provides sort of grid services as well. So the solar is one of the, we used to do lots of different technologies, and we've actually sort of slimmed down, and we now just provide solar batteries and electric vehicle charging infrastructure. And the main reason is they're very reliable technologies, and they are very readily deployable in lots of different situations. So the, as Catherine sort of touched on earlier, the one area we really struggle with is essentially office blocks. You know, there's not much generally office blocks. You can do facade mounted solar. It's generally not particularly cost effective, but pretty much every other building, there is something you can do. Where you will find essentially, you know, the real sweet spot is a large open roof space and a high energy demand. If you have a low energy demand and a tall building with a slate roof, you're going to find that your cost of installs are high and your benefits are low. But essentially what we're able to do for every project is we take a customer through a process where we show them essentially what systems look like, how much they will cost, what the benefits will be before they essentially have to commit to doing anything. So depending on what your requirement is, you know, they're pretty clear on showing what's possible. I think, you know, to Tom mentioned, you know, the road to kind of net zero. We have lots of clients who are aiming for that. That is what they're trying to get to. And it's really difficult. Going net zero is a real challenge. But we still, and I say we as in the UK, have a huge amount of low-hanging fruit. So starting the journey to net zero is actually, it's a very profitable thing to do. Essentially, you could borrow money, install a solar system, pay back, you know, the leasing on the system and be in profit from day one. You know, that's how the financials work at the moment. Once you start getting over, for most businesses, 50, 60%, you know, sort of self-consumption, you know, from generated energy, it starts getting really difficult and starts getting really expensive. So, you know, the net zero journey is we're at a very early stage of it, but the further down the road you get, it gets much more challenging. The grid connection issues become a real problem. And, you know, there's issues where you essentially businesses, you could end up in a competitive advantage if you've got two manufacturing businesses on either side of a road on an industrial estate. One of them installs solar panels all over their roof. They could effectively take up the grid capacity in that area, and their neighbouring business may not be able to install solar panels because there's no capacity left on the grid. So there are a huge amount of challenges for businesses out there.
And just briefly, Gabriel, one final point on the types of buildings. Does it matter if you're in a rented building?
So we work a lot with landlords and tenants, and it's really interesting because we essentially we get asked by either the landlord or tenant, and for us it kind of really doesn't make any difference. We're still installing the same systems, but it's just a different metering setup. So in a lot of cases the tenant wants to basically lower their energy costs, and they want to you know, have a better green credentials, and generally then it's just a conversation with the landlord and maybe a slight tweak to the lease, but normally they're sort of on a fully repairing lease anyway, and it's just getting their landlord sign off. And generally you would only do that you know, if you're in the building, you know you're going to be there for at least 5 years, but probably sort of 10 years plus what we see from most of our clients. So from a tenant's point of view, that's normally fine, unless if you've got really bad relations with your landlord, maybe not, but generally there's the landlords are quite happy. They will normally sort of agree to purchase the system from the tenant when they leave, which obviously they're part of the new EPC requirements. There's quite a lot of requirement for landlords to put it on anyway, so they're generally in a good position. And then the other way around, landlords who own lots of properties, actually it's quite profitable to put solar panels on their properties and then actually sell the energy to their tenants. So sure. There's again a bit of a negotiation, because as I said, most tenants are on a fully repairing lease, and if the landlord starts putting things on the roof, there sometimes have to be a few changes to the lease agreement to allow it. But essentially then in most cases the landlord would then become a second supplier to the tenant and usually offer to sell that on-site generation at a cheaper price than the standard electricity. So we do a lot in that sector for both the landlord and for the tenant. And as far as I'm aware, we haven't had any projects closed down by either party digging their heels in and not wanting to get involved. But it's just generally that you're security, as long as you're going to be in the building, if you're a tenant, for long enough to make it worthwhile, the expenditure is generally the biggest hurdle.
Tom, let me come back to you and come back to you with a sort of broader question. And let's just think about some of the measures that businesses can take maybe to sort of mitigate rising energy costs. Could you give us a sense of what those are?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think Kath and Gabriel have done a decent job sort of setting some of those out. I think, one of the things that we haven't talked about quite so much is actually the sort of new ways of working that we're sort of thinking about in business as a result of the pandemic. So obviously we've had an explosion in home working and a reimagining of what the office is actually for. And so people are, businesses are reimagining their footprint, their office footprint, how their staff commute to work. And I think they're generating a lot more. I think businesses are much more aware, I think, of what they're doing now as a result of the pandemic. They've had to sort of create reporting systems and collect the data about how they're using their office space or their commercial footprint, how their customers and how their staff are sort of journeying to their places of work as well. And I think that's forming part of the longer term strategy that Kath talked about. It's all part of that sort of holistic plan that businesses are putting together. I think actually that does come with an interesting new dynamic as well in terms of employee relations. And I think employees are very invested in companies' sort of net zero and decarbonisation agendas. But if the business is saving money on energy costs, employees are going to think, well, actually, is that just going to be passed on to me if I'm working in my home, for example? So there is a sort of a recalibration, I think, a renegotiation of the sort of employer-employee relationship at the moment. And obviously, staff have a lot of power, given where we are at the moment in terms of labour shortages, wage increases are going up, as is inflation. So that dynamic is one of the interesting repercussions of what we're seeing.
Well, we can see a demonstration of this on this call, can't we? I think that 3 out of 4 of us are doing this from home. One of the questions I'd like to try and answer at Tortoise actually is whether remote working is good or bad for the net zero transition. And I think one of the questions it relates to is how much energy we're all using at home and whether this is involves some people working from home and then doing quite even longer commutes perhaps than they did before. Tom, if I can come back to you. One of the things that we sort of touched on in this conversation is businesses of different sizes. What are the differences across size in the way that businesses are able to react to this situation?
I think it's largely about capacity, I think. As I think Kath and Gabriel both pointed out, this is part of a sort of a holistic view of costs and strategy. Large businesses are blessed with the fact that they'll have someone who is responsible for purchasing energy. They'll have someone who's responsible for the sustainability direction of the company for procurement generally. So it's much easier to sort of segregate those tasks, and obviously they have sort of more capacity to put towards the task as well. for smaller companies, I think across this space, they are looking for they're looking for organizations to help point them in the right direction and do five things, you know, first. You know, they're often bombarded with, you know, sales companies sort of thinking that this is the best thing that you can do right now. And it's difficult to decipher what's useful information versus what's just someone trying to sell you something. So I think there is definitely a market for, you know, more independent, trusted advice sources, which have the brand that businesses can really get on board with. And, you know, we are thinking about in the CBI space around what resources we make available, given that, you know, largest business association, we can be that sort of center of gravity for good advice, using the best from our membership, basically. So yeah, it's how we cut through some of that, help smaller businesses to sort of see the wood from the trees, I suppose.
Thank you, Tom. Kath, I'd like to just come back to you and just think about sort of pulling some of these strands together, maybe, and also thinking about the sort of the duration of this. So at what point do you see this beginning to settle down? I mean, I don't think anybody expects this to be over by this winter. And I think we're in for quite a long and sort of potentially quite bumpy ride here.
Yes, we would agree. And it goes back to that point that, you know, we had an issue about supply and demand of gas globally prior to the Ukrainian situation, and that hasn't reduced. So, you know, we had the increased demand from China as a result of them sort of switching from coal to gas, obviously something that was encouraged from an environmental perspective. So we did have a supply and demand issue prior to that situation. Clearly, the situation in Ukraine has exacerbated that situation. And we also have new directives out of the EU, such as the requirement to have gas storage levels at 90% full by the 1st of November, which has greatly increased the gas demand over this summer. But that's going to continue to support gas prices both this summer, throughout the winter, and we expect into next summer. You do still see a drop off in prices from April 23 onwards, but that drop off is nothing like as much as it has been. So we've had real volatility in the market up until sort of March 23. But what we've seen over the last few months is this steady increase of prices after that. So if you like, the really high prices are still in year one, but year two and year three are at historically very high levels. You know, we were looking at levels of around 50. We're now looking at levels of around 150. So it's a fundamentally different market that we're seeing. And we do see that taking place, that sort of continuing, these high prices. There will be variations, but we do see that continuing for the next 2 to 3 years, because the solution to some of these projects are physical solutions, and therefore they're not solutions, with the exception of energy efficiency, that you can necessarily introduce very quickly. You know, the advantage of sort of the Russian gas, if you like, is the fact that the infrastructure is in place. So to create something that's going to replace some of that infrastructure is going to take a medium-term solution. So for us, we do see this energy sort of gas sort of supply demand situation really continuing for the next two to three years. And that's what we're really advising our clients, that there's not going to be sort of some magic solution. And if you look at sort of investment in renewables, whether it's offshore wind or onshore wind or solar, whatever that is, again, they have a time lag that takes place. It takes you X amount of time to deliver a new to earth renewable asset, not least of which because of restrictions that there may be in the grid at the areas that you're trying to look at. And that in itself can, you know, delay new to earth assets being able to go live. So all of these solutions have a 2 to 3 year horizon. And that's really what's driving our view that we are in a high energy price world for the next 2 to 3 years.
And Kath, one final question to you, and briefly, if I can ask you to address this briefly. How much do you see demand management playing a part on the business side?
Well, we've always been very keen on demand management. It's been one of the services that we've offered to our customers for a considerable period of time. And, you know, in the old days, there were specific sort of incentives, if you like, because you could avoid certain high regulatory charges if you did demand management. I'm sure many people listening here will be familiar with triad avoidance and those kind of schemes that you could do to reduce your cost base. And that's still the case. There are still times of peak demand, and there are still times that you can address your cost base. And the incentive is even greater now to try to do that. And the understanding of how you use your energy. And the other thing that we're obviously really encouraging our customers to do, if it's possible from an emissions point of view, is look at switching from, you know, a highly emitting fuel such as gas, perhaps a less emitting carbon fuel such as electricity. And there are some government schemes available to support businesses in, you know, trying to undertake those activities. But yeah, demand management continues to be important. And it's just the whole focus on energy and how you use it, where you can reduce it. You know, and it comes back to sort of some of the simple things like the base load audit. You know, oh, we switch everything off when we go home at night. No, you don't, because there's a load of power you're still using at night, or there's a load of gas you're still using at night. So sometimes there is some real low hanging fruit that you can do to for businesses that seem very simple and they think they've addressed, but often they haven't. Or they did 4 or 5 years ago, but since then bad habits have crept back in and everybody's got used to leaving everything on and not worrying about it. I will say, though, to pick up on Tom's point about working from home, I think businesses now are a lot more imaginative about how they interact with their employees, and also much more imaginative about, you know, what the work solution might look like. And that's certainly something, you know, positive that's come from sort of the COVID situation. And there's also, again, it comes back to the different solutions work for different employees. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the same solution. And one of the benefits it gives you, and we've certainly found this as a business, is you're not geographically restricted anymore. We've got employees who work all over the country in a way that, you know, we might have had a physical restriction because we wanted people to come into the office. Now we're much more relaxed about that. If, you know, our offices may be in Leeds, but we have people who are in London, that's fine. You know, we even, you know, have one employee who's abroad, that's also fine. It's more about what the people can bring.
Thank you, Kath. Yeah, flexibility is something that we've all learned from the pandemic, I think. Yeah. This is a gloomy topic that we've talked about, but I think I've really enjoyed this conversation because it's been upbeat and it's been solutions focused. So thank you all very much. I'm very grateful to all our panelists, Kath Chapman, Gabriel Vondrasch and Tom Thackray. There's no webinar for the next 2 weeks, but members can sign up for the CBI's Net Zero conference, which is the 7th and 8th of June. Thank you all very much.